Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Thank you, everyone, for joining me for another awesome and amazing behavior health integration episode. Today, we have a very special guest,
Ashley Youngian Boudelotis.
Ashley is a proud women's mental health advocate. Ashley is an adjunct faculty professor at St. Catharines University. She is the women's division chair for the Minnesota Psychological Association. She is also the chief of psychology and strategic planning at the AJR & Company Consulting and Bold Wellness, where her mission is to boldly focus on the mental health and wellness of women in their personal and professional lives. It's a great pleasure having Ashley on the show, and without further ado, let's get started. Well, Ashley, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, of course. Again, it's always nice to have a fellow Minnesotan on the show, especially when into the mental health field. So,
yes, absolutely. As you and I have talked about, it's just great to, you know, take the time to get together and talk about mental health.
Yeah. And again, I just know we're going to get into a lot of great stuff. Did you have a particular event that really motivated you to get in this field? Was it a calling for you? How did that go about?
I was always interested in psychology just because of that merger of people and science. Mm-hmm. There are a ton of occupations where you're really working with people all the time and the importance of evidence-based, like there is in our profession. So I knew that I liked the field. And then when I was in college, I actually had a cousin who had a brain tumor. I was about 10 at the time, ultimately passed away from that brain tumor, but got to know just his medical team and the psychologists in the hospital and the social workers in the hospital that he was in, and just seeing the impact that they had on his life and on his parents and his sister. I found that very inspiring. And thought, yep, this is the area that I want to go into, and decided to look for PhD programs.
So what role did the psychologist play throughout his process, if you can remember?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the wonderful things about hospitals that have pediatric interdisciplinary teams, where there is a medical doctor who, of course, is, you know, working in their specialty. And then they have the amazing bedside nurses that are helping. But psychologists will be brought in, first of all, to assess, you know, how is everybody doing from a mental health standpoint? How is this family system doing? And then they will start to just spend time getting to know them, providing that sort of mental health support, and then also act as a liaison to the rest of the medical team, right? So that they're telling the medical team, you know, mom and dad aren't speaking up necessarily when you come in to do rounds, because they don't understand this or that piece. Could you guys explain this? Could you ask more questions, right? So it's really that, just how can we help be some of the glue that's trying to hold everybody together during that really difficult time.
Oh yeah, I can't imagine, again, that process and how emotional it was for everyone.
Yes, emotional, and just being able to see that a mental health professionals can have a lot of roles. And the way that we can help people can look really different than maybe you see on a movie or a TV show. It can do a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah. I could totally relate to, especially the social media aspect of it and movies and how we're portrayed at times.
Yes. Yeah. But it was, you know, it helped me to go into the field with that mindset of, okay, this can lead to a lot of different kinds of things.
When you become a psychologist or a therapist, do you ever get stereotyped by other people? Like, oh, like you're building a friendship with someone, but they know you're a therapist. Like, oh my God, are they analyzing me right now?
Yes. Or, you know, just having having those sort of tell me more during one-on-one conversations where people will mention that, or you're making sure that you're like, this is a friendship and I'm not your mental health professional. No, I certainly think it's something where people raise an eyebrow when you say I'm a psychologist.
Or if you're on a date, the other person's analyzing you. Are they analyzing me right now? And it's just.
My husband may say that occasionally still after being married for 8 years.
Does your husband have that with you or?
Yes. And he's an entirely different field. He's a hydrogeologist. So I can ask him about water and rocks and the outdoors. And then we talk about mental health as well.
Interesting. Nice. So you got your undergrad degree. Did you know right away, hey, I want to go to the PhD program? Or were you thinking about being like a master level clinician though too?
Oh, I took a couple years off and wanted to just work for a while. So I took, that's not true. I took a full year off before really going through that process and worked on the South Side of Chicago and forensic psychology in their juvenile courthouse and detention center down there, and did some community psychology research. And ultimately decided I wanted to be in that PhD program. I was doing research at the time and loved it. And that was a good avenue for me to go down because of that interest.
So could you give any of my listeners some friendly advice where maybe they're master level clinicians, or let's say even undergrad level, they're thinking or contemplating a PhD or a PsyD program? Is there pros and cons to each one? Or is there any particular reason why they shouldn't?
It's an individual decision, absolutely, depending on what do you actually want to do, because there are so many different things that you can do with a psychology degree. For me, I thought at the time, I want to have a lot of flexibility. I wanted to be able to do some research, maybe go into academia, definitely do clinical work as well. And I really like being in school, those people. And so for me, right, it made sense at the time where I just wanted to go straight into the PhD program where you get your master's along the way. But you don't need that. And it is not necessary if you're not wanting to do research, if you're not wanting to go and become a full professor somewhere down the line. So if you want to just do really good clinical practice, I think a master's is a great place to be. Fewer loans, less time out of your life.
I'm going to say this. One of my supervisors did give me advice because I was kind of contemplating like a clinical PsyD, because I do like one-on-one type of clinical work. I mean, she's like, Jake, that's awesome, but life is too important. And if you go for the PsyD, I mean, yes, I learned a lot, but it's grueling. I think it's like 5 years of high intensity type work. And she just flat out told me, again, I'm not going to mention any names, but like, don't do it. Like because she had such a stressful, anxiety written time trying to pursue that route.
There's a lot of stress that goes along with it. So I did my graduate work for 5 years down at Oklahoma State. I went down there because they had a pediatric psychology specific program. And at the time, that's really what was driving me. It went to a lab that was one of just a handful in the country that allowed you to specialize in pediatrics that early. So it was 5 years down there. I met my husband down there. So I'm happy I did it. Yes. And he came up here then to Minnesota, where after 5 years there, I did a year here of what we call a residency. We call it an internship, but in a hospital for a year, and then another 2 years after that of a postdoc at Mayo Clinic. So that's 8 years of school.
I just have to say, your husband sounds like an amazing man, willing to work with you and uproot to Minnesota when he's from Oklahoma, right?
Yes.
I can imagine that being a little culture shocky.
Absolutely. Yes, it was. But he's a trooper, and my family was up here. So it was wonderful that I matched to come back up. We didn't know if that would happen. And he's been really supportive just through this whole process.
I liked what you mentioned too. Like, hey, if you just want to do really good one-on-one clinical work, you know, master's is just fine. And then you can get licensure and you could do a lot just with that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's, I think, a matter of, you know, people really just slowing down. And instead of being in this mindset of, I have to go get this PhD or this ID, just saying, what do you want to do with it? And is it worth it for you to spend that much money in 8 years earning your degree? If so, wonderful. If you want to just do great clinical practice, and I don't mean to say just, but if you want to be solely focused on clinical practice and not do the other things, get a master's and then get into the field sooner.
Now, with PhD, does the school pay for some of your tuition? Is that the difference a little bit?
It depends on the school. There are some schools out there that pay very little of your tuition. You know, there's been a lot of talk about student loans. We don't need to go down that rabbit hole, but you know, when you are doing something for that many years where you aren't getting paid minimum wage, you don't have a ton of options.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm six figures in student loans. So I hear you on that one.
Okay. Yes. And I love the work that I'm doing. And for me to be able to do what I'm doing, that PhD made sense.
And you're also a professor as well. Is that true?
Oh, I'm adjunct at St. Kate's. Yes, okay. here in St. Paul. Awesome university where they're really focused on women's education. And so I get to teach the history and systems of psychology to, you know, just a classroom full of women who are really interested in that part of the field.
Oh, excellent. And teaching is so awesome. Now, if you have a master's degree, is it harder though? Let's say if you do want to be an adjunct professor like yourself, or do most universities just take doctorate level individuals?
I don't know that question. I know for, you know, not being adjunct, and if I wanted to go into a university, you know, have a lab, do research, do things like that, up that doctorate, but I would need to have that doctorate. For teaching, as I'm doing, I don't have students, you know, who are reporting to me, thing like that. And there are some that take individuals with master's degrees.
All right, good. There's some faith and some hope for some people.
Yeah. So while we all have a ton to offer, and right now, this nation also needs a lot more teachers. Mm-hmm. So if people are willing to do that, to take their mental health experience and to bring it to the classroom, I know it's needed.
Oh, absolutely. Going back to, is it called a fellowship for your PhD program?
Yes. Yep. We had a year residency or internship and then a fellowship afterwards.
And you were working more with children, or where were you at right now in this part of your career?
I actually got into the field to work with kids, went into an intensive pediatric psychology program, which really just means working with kids and families, but doing so in a medical setting. That's what that title's referring to. And I went gung-ho into it, saying, I'm going to love working with kids. Yeah. What I found out over time, it took me a while to admit it to myself, but what I found out over time is that I enjoyed working with the parents more than the kids. And I was more effective with the parents. Usually it's the mother who's coming in. And so early in that realization, I was working with a ton of women. We had some dads too, but typically it was moms that were coming in with their kids. And so once I let myself actually say, I like this adult work more, I turned a corner. And some of that happened while I was at Mayo. Some happened afterwards.
Wow. Yeah. Again, because you could help the parents kind of help the child, especially when you work with, like, let's say teenagers in the adolescent treatment centers, whatnot. You're working with them, but they still need to go back to home to their parents.
Yes. I have a 3 or 4 year old that has behavioral issues. I'm not really working with them. I'm working with their parents.
Yeah. And you're just teaching them, like, certain triggers, certain ways to communicate, right?
Yeah. Because it's not like, you know, when you become a parent, there's this manual that somebody hands you that's specific to your child and your family. And it's a learning process for everybody.
So I have to ask you, where did your passion come to get into women's advocacy?
Part of it, from what we were just talking about, was I was working with a lot of kids who had chronic pain. And that means a lot of work with moms. At the time that I was doing that, working with moms who had chronically ill kids, my son And also through some difficult medical things, he has a congenital heart disease, and that was ever present in our family. I was juggling working in a hospital setting with kids who were sick and being the mom of a kid who had to go to hospitals, right, because he was sick. And so I decided to make a change, and I went into critical care, mental health, in the middle of COVID. And that reduced me to the whole idea of providing healthcare remotely, like we're all used to doing now. But that was a way that we could really help people in rural areas where they didn't have access to a full-time mental health professional when they walked in the door of a hospital. So we could use remote technology to meet them where they're at, to provide them the care they needed, and to really connect them to that next area of services. Anyways, I'm now almost fully in the adult world of psychology, and began just looking at what are my values in this field and what's really driving me. Where do I get very excited? And it was in the areas of working with mom and working with women. Mm-hmm. And there are not a ton of folks out there that are saying, I want to make women's mental health a priority in my practice. So for me, that made sense to kind of leave the job that I was doing and strike out and say, I'm just full-time going to go into women's mental health and advocacy for women.
Because I was just going to ask you, why is that? Because isn't there a lot more women in this field than men?
Well, it depends on what level you're looking at. By that, I mean, what level of the organization? And are you looking at the people in leadership? Or are you looking at a lot of the clinicians? And many, not all by any means, but many healthcare organizations, many mental healthcare organizations are, have a lot of women that are doing clinical practice, and it's run by a lot of men.
Excellent point. No, you're right. It's the message is what we're trying to send out, right?
Yes. And so being able to really look at that experience, you know, having worked in three jobs before I decided to change routes and do what I'm doing now, all three of them in a row, my boss was a man. Right. And it was time for me to just say, where am I interested? Clinically, it was in women's health issues. And then culturally, it's just a time where that's something that's very important to me, something that I identify with. And so it's wonderful to be able to do that shift.
So I have to ask you, what is something that we could do as a society to improve this? What are some of the ways women are just getting misunderstood or misinterpreted as to mental health therapy? And
first of all, asking questions like that, right, is the place to start. It's just by opening up some of these conversations, being able to have difficult conversations and ask those questions. And like the last one you asked in terms of, but aren't there a lot of women in the field? rather than keeping that inside and not asking. So it's just asking the questions, talking to people like me, where this is what we do day in, day out, and asking women, you know, what are the pressing mental health issues? Not assuming, but actually asking. And we know that there's a couple right now, big areas where we could focus and have a major impact. Gender disparities is one that, you know, we've been talking about for decades, and yet we're still experiencing it. And that means, you know, in pay, that means in workplace environment, things like non-promotable work tasks that are typically given to women rather than men, things like intersectionality in women's mental health, and the inequities that exist in the culture are just exacerbated for women when they come and see mental health providers like me. And then just looking at, you know, how are we integrating this whole work-life thing for women, and what kind of burden and pressure is being placed on them?
And I feel like if we're going to have those conversations, you know, like something needs to be thrown away, like the ego, again, I find it as a human being thing, but it's like, if we really need to improve our system, we got to ask the really tough questions. And again, throw away the ego, throw away like our fear, and just again, really try to have an understanding of what's going on.
Throwing away the ego and just saying, you know, this is what I know. This is what I don't know. Understanding that, you know, women are working their butts off. And this is coming after a lot of what was coined a while back, the superwoman syndrome. That idea of neglecting yourself because you want to do it all and you want to do it all perfectly. And we're in that position a generation ago where women had to do it all in order to even try to be seen as equals in the workplace.
And do you find that that's a lot of issues your clients have as it comes to like their stress, anger, anxiety, et cetera? Do you find?
Yes. Yep. And I work with, you know, a lot of women who are just at a point where the goals that they had for themselves in their life and their values, where there is just a rub and they know that something is not matching up. And usually they kind of fall into one of two camps. It's, I had this amazing job and there are other things in my life. And now these big goals that I have and doing all of these things that I'm doing to reach these goals, it's just not where my values are anymore. And so I need to stop with something that I'm doing. I need to do something different. So I feel like that's one camp, whether it's people who are looking for a career change or something, right, has to change. And then the other camp I feel like is women who just, they really like what they're doing. You know, they love if they're a mother or a partner, they love that piece. They like they're working outside of the home. They like their job. But and it's just like, I like it. I don't want to quit, right? I don't want to leave this, but yet I'm stressed all the time. And, you know, I can't sleep or I'm not taking care of myself. And now that's coming out and I'm anxious all the time or exhausted all the time. So I see that in a lot of women. And what usually is happening by the time they get to me is they're just feeling stuck with that just change and questioning and growth that we all go through, but they don't feel like they can talk about it.
Or sometimes they can't really put their finger on what it's actually like, what's happening. Cause you're already saying like, well, I have a good life, good relationship, good job, but I'm just stuck for some reason. Right.
Yes. And it's just putting those thoughts right into something that they can articulate. And we don't learn that in elementary school or high school, or I mean, that's not one of the subjects we're taking. Yeah. And people don't have to know on their own how to put that stuff, you know, how to get it out of your brain and and say it and then start making changes. So that's where, you know, mental health professionals can come in a way that can be really helpful in just making actual change.
Yep. I was just wondering, do you ever get like the dilemma or the situation where society will have a lot of impact on, let's say, you know, a couple gets married, have kids. It says the wife stays home, they give up their job, their career, and they take care of kids. And that's the way it is. And I feel like, I don't know, in your opinion, do we still struggle with that as a society?
Yes and no. So we know that there are more women, you know, who were working out of the home, right? That continues to be something where dual income families is the norm. But COVID hit women really hard. Yeah. And even if they had been working outside of the home, had a career, it was more typically women than men who would leave their jobs during COVID if they didn't have childcare, if, you know, somebody needed to be home.
Yeah, no, like I've worked with women where they would have to quit their job because childcare is so expensive in our country.
Yes, that is a big piece of it is, you know, does it even make sense? Am I just working literally so that somebody can watch my child while I'm working and then I can pay them? Yes. So I think that there is, you know, it's more complex in terms of gender norms and cultural expectations than it used to be when it was, you know, this is what a woman's life looks like. But I think that the unspoken pieces or the assumption then, oh, well, you know, somebody needs to quit their job. Someone needs to work from home. I think that that's hard to deal with when it's not talked about. And, you know, research shows that women are still doing a lot more of that just family work emotion, it's called emotional labor in research, where they're maybe working full time. And then they're also doing all of the family planning, right? All of those pieces. So it's a different environment for women than it used to be. It's still challenging.
Again, like, I'm single with no kids, so I'm trying to relate, but like, I can imagine like a wife being pregnant, let's say 6-7 months down the road, and the husband's like, ooh, should we talk about this now? Or should we plan a few months ahead? And like, hey, honey, do you want to work? Or should I keep my, you know what I mean? These are, again, tough conversations a couple needs to have, right?
Yes. Yep. And I'm not a couples therapist, but I know some really amazing ones where that's a perfect time before you're at the decision needs to be made yesterday to go in early and even talk to a couples therapist, you know, a few times. It's not like you're going to go to them the rest of your marriage if you don't need to. But having tough conversations, again, just because two people get married doesn't mean that they know how to have those, even if they want to.
So I know what you mentioned before, too, it has a lot to do with individuals in a facility and in the higher places, like in management, to send a certain message. As men in the mental health professional field, like, what can we be doing better to be more open to our female clients' needs?
So asking them about their experience without making any, you know, preconceived judgment that, you know, a woman is coming in to see me for women's issues, right? And sticking that label on it. But really just taking the time to slow down. You can ask somebody, really no matter what their gender is, you know, what their comfort level is with talking to a male therapist, especially if it's somebody you're in a place where you can get assigned clients and they didn't just seek you out. So have those conversations. And then there's plenty of information out there that therapists can find out more about, whether it's taking continuing education units, you know, reading books, just having more information. I wish that in our training programs in mental health, that this could be brought up just like other clinical issues that we're learning about, to normalize talking about women's health. At mine, it was not. Was it at yours?
A little bit, especially like in our multicultural counseling class, you know, there's some aspects that were introduced. But again, it's always important to keep learning, keep growing, and keep doing better in that regards, because we have a lot of work.
Yeah, and I love that it was brought up in yours. I wish that we all just had a course, right, where part of it was about women's mental health, part was about men's mental health. That's important, obviously, as well, or non-binary mental health, because the gender divide can be so different in how things are presenting in their mental health symptoms.
Do you feel like the Me Too movement has a lot to do with how we kind of portray women now, or feminism in itself?
Oh, feminism has been portrayed in a lot of ways over the years.
It's so powerful, though, at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there were, I could open up a whole can of worms. I think that during that movement, that there were women who saw some advocacy, saw some voices raised that hadn't been raised in a while.
Okay.
You know, if you look back at a lot of political movements, over our country's history, you will find women's voices, really leading that. You know, especially, women of color and women that people would say, you know, those are angry women raising their voices. Yet that's what women are called sometimes when we're loud. rather than just passionate or direct. But I think the Me Too movement was an example of women saying, this is something we don't want to put up with anymore. I think that there's been some political changes since that movement that have been really challenging for women and are not giving voices to women. So it's been an up and down.
Absolutely. Now I want to move into a different direction. Now, as we talked about clients, I'm sure there's women in the mental health professional field like yourself that are going through some challenges and barriers that would need some advocacy. Am I right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And advocacy and community. And yes, and they, you know, all this remote work that we're doing now, we need to really make an effort to find each other and to support one another and to raise some topics that are, you know, important in the clinical work we do, but also in our field. Some of that is what we already referred to in terms of, you know, are women in leadership positions and giving a voice to the other women in their associations and their communities, things like that.
Has there been recent research on that, women in management and higher up positions? Because that's very interesting to find out those actual statistics on that.
Yes, there's a ton out there, and a good place to go for more information is to look into industrial organizational psychology and consulting psychology. And so that's, you know, two divisions through the American Psychological Association, where there are some, first of all, amazing women doing research in how are we being represented, and a lot of great data coming out of them.
Is one of the main barriers is like women aren't just getting promoted, like they're promoting men over women? Is it like something like that?
I think that that's a question for many fields in addition to mental health care.
True. Very true.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, always trying to do better and work towards that. But there are a lot of ingrained pieces of organizational culture and just our society's culture that women, you know, continue to experience that discrepancy, whether it's pay, you know, movement into Fortune 500 company leadership, movement into different sorts of leadership positions. I will say, I'm a part of the Minnesota Psychological Association and the chair of their women's division. And that's an organization where I've seen great representation of women in the field. In fact, our president right now, Yasmin Moideen, is a wonderful female psychologist who's been in this field for a number of years and is leading the association very well.
No, this is just really great information. We need to understand this. And it's so sad where derogatory communication, language, sexual harassment, the things that women still go through today.
It happens across professions. And you know, the best thing that we can do is just name it when it's happening, and you know, not be afraid to bring things up and have conversations, to go to the right people within your organization. If you need to do that. And you know, there is a climate in this country where women have a lot to say.
Sometimes women will use particular language or show their emotions and swear, and they're called derogatory names, where if a man does it, it's normal. It's just a man being aggressive, and that's more accepted, right?
Yes, absolutely. And so there's a book that I'm thinking of. It's called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Fantastic book. I would highly recommend it. And it walks you through the voice of women in different, you know, cultural and political conversations, and exactly to the point that you just said of how a strong, right, and a great leader, and a woman may be viewed in, you know, in a way that isn't perhaps as nice. I read a fantastic study actually from the consulting world where. People were given explanations of really a boss, in a sense, doing their job and work, right? So they were read a situation in which the boss had to have a difficult conversation with a staff member. They were asked their impression of the boss, right? These research subjects that are reading these passages. They were each given two passages. One, the boss was given a male name. The other one, the boss was given a female's name. Otherwise, exactly the same. Then they were asked their impression of the leader that was represented in the passage. And the male leader was called strong. They were called direct. They were like getting the job done. The woman was called bossy, right? Was called overly emotional and other not very kind things. Mm-hmm. But it's exactly the same situation.
Oh, man, that's powerful.
Yes. Yeah. To go back to your PhD question, right? Somebody who wants to do that study and live the life of that researcher, that's your PhD person who gets really excited, not just about reading the research, but mm-hmm. doing the research. I wasn't the best at doing the research. I was okay. Wasn't the best, but man, are people doing some really amazing things. And we have so much to learn from the scientific work out there that's being done. I just wish we all would learn more from it and pay more attention to the good stuff that's out there.
Oh, absolutely. It's powerful and it needs to be respected.
Yes, respected, but also, you know, the onus is also on researchers. People are who are doing the grant funding and publishing all of that to get it out of just being in the academic journals that are peer reviewed and you have to pay for, mm-hmm. and just figuring out how do we have these conversations in a way that's accessible and real.
It was my orientation for grad school. The director was just talking about a story. He was an internship director at the site, right? And he was so conflicted on this decision where there was a 28-year-old female intern, tall, attractive, again, nice body. This is his words, not mine. Again, this, and she's wearing these tight jeans and a nice tight like outfit, but he's conflicted on saying something because he's like, okay, that's distracting. Your outfit with your body is distracting, but he's conflicted because he didn't know if he had the right to like say that to her because it's her body. And again, his hindsight is that he's speaking more for like the clients and they may be distracted by her body and the tight clothes, which I think he ended up not saying anything to her, but it was something he was just very conflicted on.
So what do you think he should have?
Oh man, I will say this. I had a fellow intern who was the same way. I chose not to say anything to her, but it even got to the point where like clients like saying, oh, like her outfit's so tight and this and that. It's like, you want to tell the client, hey, no, stop it. That's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. But again, it's her tight outfit. So I didn't feel like it was my place, even though I did want to say something, because I just want to tell her the way you're dressing is distracting to the male clients. But I did not. I think he should have. And it would have been a very uncomfortable conversation. But what I was taught in my internship, where one of our directors was doing like a presentation, and she showed a picture of like two people in front of a mirror. And it said, before work, if you look in the front of the mirror and are like, ooh, I look good, you need to go back and change. So then that was like the main topic of that presentation. So if you feel like you look like really nice and good, you got to go back and change to a different outfit. Because I think she's portraying like, that's not what your work should be about. You shouldn't be at work just to like look lean and good. Like there should be maybe a different message.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there is, you know, the perception of who a psychologist should be in a clinical setting has really changed over time. That idea of a clinician has to be an absolute blank slate. Yeah. Where not that everybody is one, not back to Tabula Rasa stuff, but like that you should just be there. Nothing should be known about you, you know, plain dress. Not now share, you know, personal details about clients, things like that. But I'm a human being and so is that client.
They don't want to think that you're a robot.
And so, right. I mean, trust is not the best when it comes to somebody talking to a blank wall, right? We need to be able to to have those conversations. And that's part of telehealth too, where it's broken down some of those walls. But you know, I would say with kind of what that individual was wearing, would always go back to, well, if somebody else is distracted, then you probably need to figure that out.
True.
That's not on the part of that woman to then really think, oh, how is everybody going to feel today when I walk into a room with them about what I'm wearing? Because think of all the extra cognitive effort that's going to take her versus a male in that grad program who, and this is a gross generalization, but probably isn't thinking that same thought and having to use energy for it.
Regardless if it's residential treatment or not, you're there to get better, to help. Like, that's where your energy and focus should be. Hopefully you're, as an adult, you're at the point where it's like, oh, okay, she looks good, this and that. But that shouldn't like greatly affect your ability to really focus on the material and topics.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are plenty of strategies that you learn as a clinician to really address those things in the session as well, right? If those sort of thoughts are frequent and distracting enough to that individual, it's probably not just in that one situation. So let's talk about it, right? Let's learn some skills that you can use when you're having those thoughts about a woman in front of you. How are you going to cope with that in the next environment where it happens?
You know, it's funny. I talked to many female therapists and their male clients would just tell them, I find you attractive, I want to have sex with you. And the female therapists don't block them or deny it. They welcome that information. So again, they could handle that transference more efficiently, so it's in the client's benefit.
Mm-hmm. And you know, if that sort of a thing is happening and it's no longer a good fit, we stick with that client until they do find a good fit. But still, you can transition care if there is something so big that's going on in that therapeutic relationship that it's no longer working. I mean, we know that fit is the most important piece of a therapeutic relationship. If the fit isn't there, you're probably not going to get those great outcomes that you're looking for. Yet we're not, on and off the soapbox. We know from decades of research how important fit is, but we can't really incorporate that, right? When we are looking for clients, insurance certainly isn't asking about fit. So we as clinicians know that piece. I'm so happy that the SciPac legislation has gone through, which really, you know, it's an interstate compact that allows some psychologists with a doctoral degree to practice telepsychology across state boundaries so that we can now, I can see clients in 31 states, two other states are working on the legislation so that if I have a woman, you know, who's halfway across the country, as long as she's in a SciPac state, she can say, I really want to work with a psychologist who specializes in women's health and we can find each other. So I already be working with a gentleman who would have those sort of conflictions, right? There's a concern there. Not only can I say, maybe this isn't the best fit anymore, but then I have a lot more options for transfer or to really make a focused recommendation that's going to be the best for that client.
Oh, absolutely. I hope they do that for master level clinicians as well down the road.
I do too. And I've heard there is that the discussion is active, but it makes so much sense so that we can just increase access to care and get rid of some of the barriers that have been in place.
Absolutely. Well, Ashley, thank you so much for being on the show. I had a blast. I learned so much from you. I really have.
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking me and for, you know, not just talking about, hey, women's mental health is, you know, something that should be on our radar, but you took the extra step to say, well, do you want to come talk about it? It's mm-hmm. So it's these sort of conversations that's going to continue policy work, that's going to continue, you know, important insurance coverage work and just understanding, you know, women's mental health. It's a thing and it's a really important thing. So let's do something about it.
Oh, definitely. And I got to ask you too. I know you're doing a lot. But just thinking ahead in the next 5 years or so, are there any future projects you want to work on or any type of work you want to get deeper into?
Yeah, so I have, you know, been in my private practice for almost a year, but still I was in healthcare, right, for a very long time. So being able to dig into this private practice and continue to grow in my education about the most pressing issues in women's health. One of the really cool things about psychology is it's a science and there will always be new information about how we can help each other the best. So I look forward to doing that and then to do more of what I'm doing already in terms of speaking and meeting with individuals, whether it's policy or, you know, being invited to work in small leadership groups at organizations, speak at conferences, so that more people are able to find out about how important this is.
I hope you keep up the great work. You're really inspirational. And if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there a particular website or number they could use to make contact with you?
So you can get in contact with me through my website. And through there, you can either make an appointment to, you know, see me as a clinician or to do more of a consulting, speaking, or coaching sort of a relationship. And so my website, and I'd be happy to send it to you in writing too, so you can put it with this, but it's ajrcoconsulting.com.
I'll make sure I put that link on my show notes. All my listeners have it.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me. And again, for just making this a priority enough to do a podcast about it.
Oh, it was so much fun and the pleasure is all mine.
I again want to thank Ashley for another amazing BHI episode. I just want to thank all of my fans for your support and also to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health professional. All right, everyone, thank you and have a good day. Bye.